Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield
down by the riverside.
Down by the riverside.
Yeah.
Down by the riverside.
I'm gonna lay down my sword and shield
down by the riverside.
I'm gonna study.
Thank you, Lewis. And now, whether cultural representations of war can change your opinion of war from the Iliad to the Hunger Games. Today, as part of our ongoing series called End of War, we're talking about cultural representations of war on stage, in film, in video games, and other pop culture. Joining us for this are three guests. Clive Thompson, contributor to the New York Times Magazine and columnist for Wired, is here in our studio. Also joining us are Janine Basinger, chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and Dennis O'Hare, the actor and co-author of the play An Iliad, which is currently running at the New York Theater Workshop. Welcome to you all. Thank you very much for coming on.
You're welcome.
Hi, Brian.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Did any movie, play, book, song, video game, whatever, change your opinion about war? 212-433-WNYC. And Professor Basinger, the central question of this series is war inevitable, or can human beings abolish war? So if you form your opinion on that question based just on war movies, what do you think your answer would be? Do war films, even anti-war films, reinforce the idea that war is an inevitable part of life?
What I would say is that any war film you see is a kind of anti-war film, but horribly on the other side, any anti-war film you see is kind of a war film. So the paradox for making it visual and putting it in front of people in a dark theater is that you activate issues about courage and bravery and camaraderie and heroism and patriotism, and people go out a little bit like, they can enjoy the spectacle without having to experience the horror. The film director, Sam Fuller, had a great quote. He was actually a combat veteran. He landed at Omaha Beach, and he was a member of the Big Red One, the United States 1st Infantry Division. And mm-hmm. he said, to make a film about war, to show the audience what war is, you would have to bring in troops on stage and have them shoot at the audience. He said, otherwise it's not going to work. So, you know, it's one of those things. You experience the glory, the excitement, with none of the responsibility. I fear it doesn't help. There's always a little glamour. There's always a little beauty. There's always a little bit of that fatal attraction to it.
Here's a clip from the 1989 film Born on the 4th of July. Maybe it's going to sound a little different in the context of that answer.
I don't believe in him anymore.
Go to bed, honey.
Because you
only
had to spend 3 days up there. Me, I got to spend the rest of my life. I wish I were dead like him.
You don't know what you're saying.
That's the problem, Mom. I'm not dead. I got to live. I got to live and I got to roll around. I got to remind him of Vietnam. And you don't want to know. You don't want to see us. You want to hide us. You want to hide us because it is a can of shit. And I am a fucking dummy.
He won't listen. He won't change.
Ronnie, please. You got to take your mom seriously. You can't drink in this house.
They told us. Go fight. Go kill. Sergeant, ma'am. Ring, car. Yes, car left. Car left. Car left. You know, it's all a lie. The whole thing is just a bunch of
money.
Why?
Stop it. Go to bed. You sleep it off. What did they do to you in that war? What happened to you? You need help, Ronnie. You need help.
You need help.
Whew. Boy, Janine, it's hard to listen to that and think, yeah, okay, let's launch another war.
Well, you know what? That is the Vietnam War defined, and there are other war films that people are seeing that have a different purpose. And the difference between words and images, when you listen to those words, when you hear those words, definitely. And by the way, does anyone go into the theater thinking war is a wonderful idea? But there's something seductive or, you know, kind of, you just, it's complicated, you know? I don't think all of literature and art telling us what a bad deal it is has unfortunately has not been able to end it.
Before we move on to some other aspects, just thinking of a list of, you know, classic war / anti-war films, are there any that you would distinguish with your knowledge of the field that do, in terms of doing this any more than any others, exceptions or whatever? Doctor Strangelove, Apocalypse Now, Born on the 4th of July, Coming Home, Full Metal Jacket, Hotel Rwanda, The Thin Red Line. Any one of them stand out?
Well, I would say that a film that for me personally made me really appreciate what war did to people was an older movie, The Best Years of Our Lives, because when you see how war changes the individual and affects then not only the people who fought it, but those they come home to, that was a lesson brought home to me personally very clearly. When you're experiencing watching combat and the danger and excitement of combat in a film, it has a different effect.
Clive Thompson, if you look just at popular culture, youth culture, video games, for example, which you write about, how do you think you would answer the same question? Does it make you think war is inevitable, and can they mitigate against feelings of acceptance of war?
Well, I think the vast majority of war video games probably fall into the same problem Gene's talking about. They really get you sort of this combination of excited, distressed certainly, but excited about the prospect of war. They're very similar to, you know, the sort of schlocky action movies. Over time, they've definitely developed more disturbing elements. I mean, there was a controversial scene in a game a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago, where you had to participate in being undercover in essentially a terrorist attack on a Russian airport, and you watched as innocent people were just gunned down. And a lot of people found that a really upsetting and thought-provoking episode to go through. So you do see these moments inside the games. They're not devoid of reflection on war, but they're not omnipresent. And I think that's partly because they suffer from the same – games now suffer from the same problem Hollywood suffers from. It costs, you know, $10, $20, $30 million to make a game. So you have to make it, you know, you can't make it the downer of the game, right? Interestingly, the thing that's happened with video games is that the field has become so diverse that there's actually a bunch of smaller, almost auteurist games, similar to what you could call the indie movie movement of the 60s and 70s, that actually have tackled war in some very interesting ways, including very cleverly trying to look at this question of what happens on the home front. Right.
Dennis O'Hare, in writing an Iliad, you grappled with how to produce a representation of war. You, with your co-author and director Lisa Peterson, crafted a retelling of the Trojan War as a response to the Iraq War. This is a one-man show. You alternate performances with Stephen Spinella.
Yep.
Why go all the way back to the Trojan War?
Well, it's the greatest war poem ever written. And it's possibly the first play, if you think about the fact that it was performed. And I find it interesting that the first dramatic spectacle should be concerned with war, which is obviously something that concerned these people and these cultures. Lisa was looking around for theatrical works that were responding to the fact that we had just invaded Iraq in 2003, and was not finding them, and was not finding the current theatrical scene grappling with this topic. So she found herself going back to the Iliad, and she asked me to sit down with her and sort of meditate on it. And we spent up about 3 or 4 years developing it, 5 years developing it, and we came up with this script. And, you know, I think we both had an agenda. Lisa's agenda, if anything, became more attenuated. Her idea was that violence is inchoate to human nature, and humans are inevitably violent. And my thesis was sort of that war is a waste. And we found that neither agenda was purely represented in an Iliad, which is a great work of art, and it doesn't really have a single agenda. Those things are in there, but neither idea is paramount. And what we end up presenting on stage is a picture of human nature and of the human experience. many things happen in the Iliad besides fighting, but the majority of the action is about killing. And we end our play with Hector being killed by Achilles and then the funeral of Hector. And it's a pretty staggering story. It's difficult to listen to, and it's difficult to perform.
So listening to Janine's answers before, does it make you throw up your hands and say, oh, you know, after all the work we did to make an anti-war play, it's just going to wind up reinforcing the whole thing anyway?
You know, you can never control what an audience takes away from a work of art. You can just do your best to be honest. And so what we strive to do is to present, is to be fair to Homer's Iliad and to honor a great work. Most people are horrified. Most audience members at the end of the play are literally sitting back in their seats, sort of mouth agape at the horror of what they just experienced. We show a lot of the violence in this piece. And we end, near the penultimate moments, we list about 167 wars. There's a monologue of just the narrator gets stuck on war, and he begins to list all the wars, starting with the conquest of Sumer. And he begins to go through, and he goes all the way through Libya and Syria.
Now, hang on, because that is such a powerful moment that we pulled it.
Oh, great.
And I'm going to play this for our listeners. This is the actor Timothy Edward Cain doing it in the Chicago production of your play. And this is about a minute's worth.
Yes, yes, it was a terrible hot day during the conquest of Sumer. The conquest of Sargon. The Persian War. No, the Peloponnesian War. War of Alexander the Great. Punic War. Gallic War, Caesar's invasion to Britain, Great Jewish Revolt, Yellow Turban Rebellion, War against the Moors in North Africa, Roman-Persian War, Byzantine-Arab War, Muslim conquest of Egypt, First Siege of Constantinople, Arab-Chinese War, Saxon Wars, Viking raids across Europe, Bulgarian Siege of Constantinople, Zange Rebellion in southern Iraq, Croatian-Bulgarian War, Viking Civil War, Norman conquest of England, First Crusade, Second Crusade, Third Crusade, Fourth Crusade, Children's Crusade, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, Eighth, Ninth Crusade, Norman invasion of Ireland, Mongol invasion of China, Mongol invasion of Russia, Mongol invasion of Vietnam.
Kathleen in Manhattan, you saw that in the theater, didn't you?
Yes, I did. Just a couple weeks ago, I saw the wonderful Mr. Spinella. And my comment was exactly that wonderful to hear the story of the Greeks and the Trojans. It's never uninteresting. But when you get to this long list, what begins to drop in is another experience of what a waste. And the simplicity of the list, just the simple list of all the human waste over all those eons, was so powerful. And it reminded me of the moment in Henry V when the king lists the numbers of the dead, of the French dead. It's a great turning point in both of those plays to hear that, just that simple list, the simplicity of, after all that war and all that, you know, action on stage of the recounting of the war or the playing out of the war, just to sit in an audience and listen to the list of human waste. It's wonderful. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And this is the point in the play, Dennis O'Hare, where people are most likely to cry, right?
It's pretty staggering. We didn't know what to expect when we fashioned this. We didn't know if we would lose them or if they would get bored or restless or angry. And the audience gets stiller and stiller and stiller as the list begins to march toward the 20th century, long about, you know, we say the Napoleonic Wars, the Bolivian War of Independence, Argentine War of Independence, Mexican War of Independence. They begin to get the idea that we're heading toward present day. And as we hit World War I and Russian Revolution and Third Anglo-Afghan War, they begin to get very still. And by the time we get to Cold War, Korean War, Cuban Revolution, Vietnam, Bay of Pigs, Sand War, Six-Day War, Laos, Cambodia, the audience is just rapt. And at the end, there's usually a pause. And in the pause, you hear people stifling something. It's it's just a picture of human nature, and it's pretty overwhelming.
Dennis O'Hare, Janine Basinger, Clive Thompson will continue in a minute with whether cultural representations of war can change your opinion of war from the Iliad to the Hunger Games as we continue our End of War series.
Down by the riverside, I'm gonna lay down my burden. Down by the riverside, study one or more.
The Million Dollar Quartet's version this time as we continue our End of War series and ask today whether cultural representations of war can change your opinion from the Iliad to the Hunger Games. With us are Janine Basinger, chair of the Film Studies Department at Wesleyan, Dennis O'Hare, the actor and co-author of the play An Iliad, currently running at the New York Theater Workshop, and Clive Thompson, contributor to the New York Times Magazine and columnist for Wired Magazine, and Clive, the Hunger Games. Suzanne Collins says she didn't write a trilogy about the metaphorical war that is adolescence. She says she was writing about war, not a metaphor. Do you think young adults, her audience, gets this? The movie's going to open. My middle school son is reading the book, one of the books. They grew up with 9/11, with the Iraq War, war in Afghanistan. Maybe they get war on some level.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think young people understand war deeply. When I was young, it was during the Cold War, and I understood what was going on and was incredibly distressed by it. Despite, in some senses, my parents' attempts to not talk about it with me, kids pick this stuff up. And I think what is so striking about when you read The Hunger Games is how ambiguous everyone's motives are who are in power, right? You know, you have the ambiguity, you have the evil of the repressive regime, but it turns out the resistance movement has its own ambiguities too. And I think any aware young person who's gone through the last 10 years has sort of, you know, there's a reason why they gravitate towards that type of message.
The premise of the movie is that each kid has to put their name into the drawing to compete in the Hunger Games, which is a battle to the death. The twist is that you can get more food each additional time you put your name into the hat. So there's an incentive for poor kids to put their names in, increasing their chances of getting chosen to fight and probably die in the Hunger Games. And I wonder, you know, maybe this is apostasy. Is this the GI Bill? Is it the same kind of perverse incentive for lower income people to join up because they think they're going to get their only route to a college education out of it? And I don't know if that's what Suzanne Collins would say.
I don't know if that's what she'd say, but it's definitely a parallel that leaps out at you. I mean, you know, this is something that soldiers talk about and is the open secret of war fighting in this country, which is that only a tiny, tiny chunk of the population fights wars, and they are increasingly from poorer and poorer parts of the country. So, you know, going to war is part of how you pay for an education. It's part of how you attempt to further yourself with the industrial economy sort of essentially torn apart. So, you know, I don't know the demographics of who are reading those books, but it wouldn't strike me as unusual if some of the readers picked up that parallel.
Celia in Rivervale, New Jersey on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to, one movie that changed or made me look at war in a different way was Saving Private Ryan. Because on the one hand, it shows the horrors of war that it causes an individual. But at the end, there's a scene at the cemetery where an old man, I think, is talking to his grandson, and he brings into question the fact that these men made terrible sacrifices for us. And we are the heirs of that. And are we living up to our responsibility? So it made me think this war was worth it, and it's up to us to every day somehow keep alive the ideals that they went to that war for.
You know, we're on the same wavelength, Celia, because we pulled a scene from the end of Saving Private Ryan to play in this segment. And so this is from the end where Tom Hanks' character is dying and reading a letter that he's written to his mother.
Nothing, not even the safe return of a beloved son, can compensate you or the thousands of other American families who have suffered great loss in this tragic war. But I might share with you some words which have sustained me through long dark nights of peril, loss, and heartache. And I quote, I pray that our Heavenly Father may assuage the anguish of your bereavement and leave you only the cherished memory of the loved and lost and the solemn pride that must be yours to have laid so costly a sacrifice upon the altar of freedom. Abraham Lincoln.
And to be more clear about what that is, because I really misspoke a little bit there, it's Tom Hanks' character reading the letter to Mrs. Ryan, the mother of the Matt Damon character. But Janine Basaker, you want to comment on that and talk to Celia?
Yes, I thought that what she said was very eloquent and accurate. Steven Spielberg actually effectively activated the popular World War II combat film for a new purpose, which was exactly to ask the audience that question, to remind them of the sacrifices that had been made and to say, do you feel worthy of those sacrifices? Have we gotten any better? Have we gotten rid of war? Are we living up as Americans to the ideals that they were presumably fighting for? And that was a purpose for the use of the war film that he made modern, and it worked very well. Audiences responded very effectively to that. So, you know, I was interested in Clive saying he'd been a child in Cold War because I am elderly, thank you. I was a child in World War II. And, you know, the way you saw a combat film or a war film is defined by the culture you're in and the purpose that it appears to be having for people. And so you take those messages very seriously. And what the play has apparently done is really make it universal and across history to remind us that we've never put our weapons down, and are we ever going to? You know, to ask our art has to keep making us ask those questions of ourselves. And the problem with a mass medium like movies is, as he also said, the money involved, they go for a more exciting or glamorous approach. But Spielberg had a worthy purpose for his activating of that mode.
Brian, do you mind if I jump in for a
second? Dennis O'Hare, go ahead.
I was looking up online just because I remembered a Stanley Kubrick film, Paths of Glory, which I think is a great look at war.
Yeah,
it's very unromantic and it's very, very dry-eyed, and it was shocking when I first saw it. But what I would say about the Spielberg film is that even in that film, at that end, to me, it feels a little bit like manipulation, because what they're trying to do is say, this was a just war, and this was a good war, and the people who died fought for the right reasons, and we have to honor them. But every war, from someone's point of view, is a just war. And every war, from someone's point of view, is the right war. And they always try to justify the dead. And I would submit that this, just like every other film, is a form of propaganda in saying that war is good. In this situation, war was good. These people died for a good reason, but they're still dead. And any time a soldier is dead, they don't get the honor, they don't get the glory, they're simply dead.
Clive, did you want to chime in?
Yeah, I think the thing that circles around a lot of the difficulties of war games and war movies is that is this problem of them having trouble representing what happens, what are the consequences that happen off the screen, you know, what happens to the dead, what happens to the families back home, and this is exactly why, you know, in video games, as far as I can see, the only really very interesting games that make you think about war in a deep way are done on the artistic margins. You know, you could, for example, go online right now and play a game called Unmanned. It just came out. It's a free game. And it's about the experience of being a drone operator. And it forces you to think, you know, some very, very troubling thoughts about the nature of conducting war, you know, out in the Nevada desert and shooting people halfway around the world. And it's a genuinely artistic game. It was done on a very low budget by an artist, Jim Monroe, and a bunch of collaborators. And so it is possible to to do these types of things and to look at what happens on the home front and when look at what happens in the sort of collateral damage to society. But it's hard to do it with a big budget in the center.
Gears of War, the video game. Here's 20 seconds.
Dom, we need to stick to the mission. We have no idea if Maria's down here. And
Marcus, I need to know. You don't have to go with me, all right?
Dom, it's just going to get us both killed. We need to get into the stronghold and activate the beacon. This is it, Dom. This is everything we've been fighting for.
Yeah? Well, Maria's everything I've been fighting for.
So in that voiceover, Clive, very briefly, because we're going to run out of time, they sort of reflect on their mission. It's the added layer you were talking about, collateral damage.
It does, in fact, happen. That's from Gears of War, where there are actually several disturbing scenes amongst all the sort of jingoistic stuff. That character is talking about the loss of his wife to the war. And there's several very disturbing scenes. You come across a community where the people are just ashes, you know, almost in that burned to ashes by a bomb. And if you touch them by accident, they just dissolve. And there's something unbearably creepy about that and disturbing. So there are moments like that.
So in our last minute, can presented culture contribute to ending or minimizing war? Or should everybody just shut up?
No, we should never shut up. We have to keep trying. It's not a good thing. Let's keep having more plays like the Iliad or whatever. But, you know, what can you say, you know?
Dennis?
I agree. I think that the responsibility of art is to reflect the culture and to ask the difficult questions. And, you know, all we can do is to hold up the mirror to life, as it were, and hope that people see in that reflection something that gives them pause.
Clive, 10 seconds.
I agree, and I think with all that, and I think that as video games mature, they'll start to join that conversation more.
Clive Thompson, Janine Basinger, Dennis O'Hare, who is an Iliad, has been extended through April 1st at the New York Theater Workshop. Thank you all very much for an amazing conversation.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And listeners, contribute to our End of War series. See our End of War survey and take it at wnyc.org/endofwar.